Okay, let's draw this together. So in a way, what we've been looking at this weekend is this particular path that is really about the fusion of opposites. And we're looking, you know, with these last few paths that we're looking at the internal dynamics of the supernal triangle. So we're looking at the deep roots of our own being. And so all the paths, each one of the paths that we look at in these last stages of the course, are profoundly connected to the other paths, and it's a question of nuance rather than this means that and this and the other path means something different. So what is emphasized in this path is the fusion of the opposite, and in particular the fusion of intention. And love for intention and imagination, because the particular card, the Empress, we find this rather lush, pregnant figure in the middle of a garden, who is, in a sense, producing all the life. So this whole transitional kind of place, really, which is crossed also by the path from Keter to Tiferet, is really about this moment of emergence, the movement from the non-dual world to the world of the time and space and movement world of duality. Because what emerges out of this place is the second triangle of the tree, which we have the energy of growth and expansion of Gedula, the energy of severity and contraction of Geburah, and the balancing energy of Tiferet. So, in a certain sense, what we're with at the upper part of the tree is what the Kabbalists call the world of Atzilut, the world of the divine, where there is no duality. The second triangle of the brings in the world of creativity and the appearance of space-time and movement within space-time. The third triangle of the tree, the Hod and Netzach and Yesod, represents the world of Yetzira, which is called the world of formation, which is the world of multiplication, where the many forms, the many forces come together into the many living images of Yesod. And that takes us into the fourth world of the tree, the world of Asiya, the world of action. So what we've also been looking at in different ways is the mirrored nature of the tree. So when the tree is operating as it should, each sphere mirrors every other. So there is a constant flow from the non-dual into the dual, from the dual back into the non-dual, and that's held within the divine name of Keter, E'aya Asha E'aya, I am that I am. I will be that which I will be. So that sense of the divine life arising out of the Keter, the root of the tree, the crown of the tree, also coming into the suchness of what appears, and then returning back into that suchness as a constant sort of flow. Now, what we've also looked at in this weekend, really, is we've looked at two aspects of the Western tradition. I feel like we've looked at the Eastern end of it in Alexandria and Egypt. We've looked at the Western end of it as we head across the Atlantic into the Isles of the Blessed. Now, the particular quality of the Western mystery tradition is that it is this tradition that does have its roots coming out of ancient Egypt, but also then comes into connection with the Mediterranean, comes across Europe, and is in dialogue with the indigenous traditions of Europe and of Britain. So when we're working with a Western tradition, Western mystery tradition, as opposed to the Judaic Kabbalah, which is very much about the religion, in particular racial history of the Jews, we're looking at a tradition, we're looking at a Hermetic tradition that encompasses both the traditions of the Middle East and the traditions of the Far West. And of course, interestingly, when we go back into the before the days in which America was discovered, the far west of Europe was seen as Britain. Britain was this strange, if you look at Britain from the continent, it's this strange misty island with these white, strange white cliffs. And where there are the and where the, you know, it's the, it was the last place the Roman Empire got to in the West, and so it was always this mysterious kind of place, that place of magic, place of mystery, and was of course the first place the Romans withdrew from as the empire started to collapse inwards. So in a certain sense, there's lots of different opposites. We're looking at the opposites, metaphysical opposites, the opposites within ourselves, but also the opposites in history and the way the Western mystery tradition has developed. And so there's a way in which, one of the things that gets pointed at the Hermetic Kabbalah very often is you're not a real tradition at all. Because actually, if you're a real tradition, you just have your particular lineage of teachers, and they're teaching this consistent thing that never changes. Now that is really, I really think that attitude is ludicrous. I've always thought it's ludicrous, because when you look at the traditions of the East, they change all the time. There is absolutely no such, this idea of the pure tradition that has this special magic secret thing that never changes is a nonsense. It doesn't exist anywhere on earth. But these days in particular, partly because of this sort of reification and people's insecurity, people look for that. But actually, so the reality of working with this tradition as it's evolved, we have a whole number of tools and sets of ideas that come from different periods of time that we can draw on. It becomes part of our treasure chest, in a sense, our kind of a collection of images and possibilities that we can work with. And so, in a way, that I suppose this weekend, perhaps more than some of the others, we've worked with both ends of the equation. We've worked with we've worked with Colette in Jerusalem. We've worked with the images out of Jerusalem. We've also worked with the image of Alexandria, and also we've worked with these images of the longing for the Blessed Isles of the West. We've also looked again at the Rollright ritual and the ideas that are found there. But the underneath intention of all of these things is really that we learn to work with that which is, trusting our particular experience in the moment. Because one of the crucial things that we've continued to look at this weekend is the mystery of the body. And the body as the receptacle of the hallows, of the holy things, that is the transmission point of holiness. So we've had this meditation. We've kept coming back to, first of all, embracing the body. It's up, it's down, it's left, it's right, it's front and it's back. And then going more deeply into the organ systems of the body. And then going into the cellular aspect of the body. And then even further going into the molecular and atomic nature of the body. And from that place, then exploring the deeper universe. But so by discovering ourselves as embodying the hallows in these different ways, we then explore the longing for the place of peace. We explore the Alexandria, the place where the opposites come together. We explore the very particular world, the particular world of Colette, and the teachings of the bone points to itself. So I'm just going to come back to the Seed of the Bone teachings for a moment. Once I find them. Okay. So I just want to go over those as well, because these teachings, in a sense, hold Well, they are the bone of the bones of what we're looking at today. So the thing about this is chapter 13, which is worth reading again in connection with this, because the whole point about the tree of life really and these teachings is that it is a kind of a relatively simple framework. We have these 10 spheres and 22 paths that give us a sort of a contemplation framework that enables us to inquire both into the mysteries of our own soul and the mysteries of the universe. And the whole point about the tree is that what it describes is this profoundly interconnected mirroring universe. And one of the phrases that you get given when you learn Kabbalah when you're young is, so you learn the phrases of the tree, and then your teacher tells you there is a tree in every sephira. So you think you've got it, and then you're told, "Oh, it's a bit more complicated than that, really." And now if you misuse that teaching, what do you then go off and do? And you produce really complicated diagrams. Whereas actually the point of the tree in every sephira means that the pattern of the tree replicates itself at every level, from the dynamics of the individual cell to the dynamics of the organ system the cell is part of, to the dynamics of the body that the organ system is part of, to the sociological dynamics that the person is part of, to the, if you like, Gaian dynamics of the world that the social world of the person exists in, to the universal dynamics of the universe. The same basic pattern of the tree replicates itself at all kind of levels. Now the bone teachings, which are a condensation of the teachings of the tree of life, which takes even the 10 and the 10 spheres and the 22 paths and does something much simpler with it, bring us back into relationship with the book of Ezekiel, and take us into a contemplation of the icon and the idol, the image that frees and the image that binds. And that we find at the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, where we looked at the cleansing of the temple and the gathering together of the good bones and the restoration of the good bones through the work of the cup. Now, what we then went on to look at really was what we talked about yesterday. Was my experience in Jerusalem looking for an Israeli Kabbalist who could teach me all kinds of mysteries, and mostly failing at that, apart from my encounter with Colette, encounters, I should say. And I make no claim, as I said yesterday, I make no claim to being a student of Colette. I wasn't really, she was somebody I came across from time to time. But I very fortunately, or I suppose more accurately, synchronously, I was there right towards the end of her life when she gave over this very particular teaching about the bone points to itself. And of course, as I said yesterday, this is a teaching that landed in me. My friend who went with, whose Hebrew is much better than mine because he lives in Israel, did not hear what I heard. But anyway, whether I heard right or didn't is not the point. This is a teaching I have worked with and have understood and worked with lots of other people with for years. And I personally believe it was what she was intending to teach. My friend Yaqub would argue with me. But what the teaching, so the phrase is a very simple phrase, right? The bone points to itself, and it is a nonsensical phrase. Doesn't mean anything if you take it as literal English. But it's actually it is a contemplation phrase. So in Hebrew it is Ha Otzem Mitzvia Al Otzemen. And cracking it or understanding it requires a bit of understanding of the poetic nature of Hebrew and the way in which it relates to root words. Now the word for bone, which is Otzem, is also the word for essence. The word the, which precedes it, is the single letter he, which the word letter he means a window. It also is used as a symbol in Kabbalah for the divine breath of Ruach Elohim. It also, as the word the, is a placeholder. When we say the, we create a space for something to emerge. So if I say the chair, the creates the space for the chair to appear in. So the very first letter of this phrase, which is, and it is the second letter of the divine name, it is the feminine letter of the divine name. So it is, in a sense, the image, it has something of the image of the empress, because it is the creative of feminine. The Ruach Elohim, the breath of divine in Hebrew, is thought of as feminine. It's the creative energy of the divine feminine bringing life into being. So Ha Otzem, the bone, the essence. So they play. So the what we are pointing at here is the, which locates, creates the space for us to contemplate the essence, the beginning point, the seed point. The second word, metzviah, means points to. It is a word of action and direction. It is the word of will and creativity. Otzem is related to the divine world of essences, of the seed points of possibility, of pure potential. Mitzviah takes that energy in a direction. The third word, Aleph Lamed, means togetherness, nearness, connection to. It's a conjunction. So this take, so the bone, the essence coming into expression creates relationship and connection. And the final word is otzemen, itself, that which appears. So this is the word of expression, the world of asiya, the world of action. The bone points to itself. The essence points to the appearance. The appearance, therefore, also points at the essence. Now, one of the things that we looked at yesterday, really, was looking at how in the book of Ezekiel, the language is very particular. When it, in the vision of Ezekiel, the throne vision of Ezekiel, when he encounters the holy living creatures, it is very careful to say the likeness of a man, the appearance of wheels, the appearance of wings. So it's pointing at a vision of the universe where everything is actually fluid, in motion. Everything is the appearance of something. It's not a separated substance. What we experience as separation is momentum. Something moving so quickly it appears too solid. As we slow everything down, slow our attention down, come into relationship with ourselves and others, what we start to experience is an arising process, which is what is being described by this phrase. Now if we take the phrase a bit more deeply, and if we look at the Hebrew in it. Hebrew letters are hieroglyphic letters. So, like Egyptian hieroglyphs, they have a particular meaning beyond the sound value as a letter. So, if we begin with we've already done this with the letter He, which is the window, which is the space creating thing, which is represents the Ruach Elohim. But if we look at the word Otzem, that begins with the letter Ayin. And the letter Ayin means the eye. The eye is the eye in the face, not the eye as a pronoun. So it begins with the sense, having connected with the divine breath, this begins with the idea of perception, of envisaging. Now, the understanding of the eye in ancient Israel was the eye was not just a receiver of things, it was a projector. So the act of perception would be seen as an act of envisioning, of bringing energy out into the world. So what is perceived? So it begins, the act, in a sense, of connecting to the divine breath, next begins with a seeing. The second letter is Tzadi. Tzadi is a fishhook. So it has this idea of fishing, and the final letter is Mem, which means the great water. So we're given this image in the beginning of this phrase of the fisherman fishing in the great waters of the unmanifest, seeking something that will emerge. Letter Tzadi as well is the first letter of the word Tzadik. The Tzadik is the holy one, the righteous one, who holds the worlds together. The letter Tzadi is a sort of a curving letter, and it speaks of the Tzadik bowing in humility. But it's a paradoxical letter, because the Tzadik is also seen as the pillar that upholds the world. So the image that we have, that we're given in the word Otzem, in the poetic image, we were given this sense of this fisherman who is fishing in the waters of the deep. The particular form of the letter Mem, which is the letter water, is it's the final letter, and which is a closed letter. So this is a mysterious water, an enclosed water that's being contemplated. So far, so good. We're in connecting with the divine breath. We're fishing in the deep waters, but and then something is perceived. Something, some essence is seeking to become known. Not yet ready to be known. It's still enclosed in the mystery of the divine. When we step into the next step, which is the world of Beriah, the world of creation, we come to this world of Metviah. This begins with the letter Mem again, but the letter Mem here is not in its closed form, it's in its open form. So this suggests the flowing of the waters. We find again the second letter of Mitzvah is again the letter Tzadi. Again, this sense of the fish hook, the fisherman, the one who is bowing, who is also the pillar that holds the earth. So the water flows through the Tzadik, the person who is embodying that essence. That is enhanced by the next letter, which is the letter Beit, which means the house. The next letter is the letter Yud, which is the seed point of the divine will. The final letter is again the letter Ayin. So what you see, and again you have to look at this study poetically, what you see happening, having connected with the divine seed, we now come into a sense of movement. We are, if you like, the person who is connecting heaven and earth, but is bowing to the divine life that is flowing through us. We make ourselves the house of the divine. We encompass the divine seed that is the letter Yod, and we see this vision coming into being. We are now, this is the original vision, is the perception of a possibility. This is the perception, the experience of the dynamism of that seed place coming into being. It takes us to the third letter, the third word, which is the letter Aleph Lamed. Now this is one of the great divine, creative divine names of the Middle East. It's a very ancient name, long before Judaism. The god El is one of the great Canaanite gods. But here, if we look at it hieroglyphically, the word Aleph, Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It means the ox. Al is the letter Lamed, is the ox goad. You place the ox goad and the Ali and the Aleph together, and you're given this image of irrigation, because you have the ox goad being, the ox being prodded by the goad, and normally what the ox does is to walk in a circle, turning the great water wheels, the irrigation wheels, and bringing seed and life out of the earth. So in this, so but it and it involves a conjunction really of the human will and the ox and the channels to enable something to flow. So the this energy of creation now moves into the a dynamic that brings the new seed out of the ground. The final word, Otsemen, brings us into the world of Asiya, the world of actual, apparent, physical, separate reality. And what this word gives, this word then gives us again the word Ayin, the letter Ayin, the word Tzadi, the letter Mem in its open form, and finally ends with the letter Nun, which is the word for fish. Now, so what happens in this process of we begin in the silence of the divine, we experience the potential of the divine seed, the essence that is seeking to be known. We become one with that process of creativity. We become one with the energy of the formation of the ox and the ox goat. And then we see the appearance in the same way that he was perceived in the actuality of the divine. We perceive the actual appearance of the divine seed as we move through Ayin, Tzadi, Mem, Nun, which is the emergence of the fruit of the sea. And then we catch the fish. We receive the fish. We eat the fish. We return to the beginning. Now, that process, now we're not, of course, going to do that letter by letter, but what the process, what this points to us, is this is the natural process of human life, of the creativity of the divine manifesting through us. It's there in the pattern of the divine name. The point above the yod is Keter, it is the Ayer Asherei Ayer. The Yud is the divine will. The letter He is the divine love. The Vav is the conjunction into art and Tiferet of love and will, coming into the triadic manifestation, which expresses itself as the living image of Yesod that comes into expression in the final He of Malchut. In the moment when we are still, when an impulse arises in us, as we follow that impulse, as we allow that impulse to inform us, as we allow as if to envisage and imagine that impulse, and as we allow that to flow through us into embodiment and into activity, we perform this act of creation. This is Yehi Or, let there be light. We become the living vehicle through which we become the living stone that embodies, that is the stone of growth and life. We become the literal philosopher's stone that generates life around ourselves. Now, what life we generate depends very much upon the intention that we draw. Now, if we draw on the deep roots of the divine, the fruit and the flowering of our life is goodness, is blessedness, is not that our life will feel blessed necessarily, but we will, because that powerful energy will bring us into the concourse of duality normally of a lot of difficulty, but we are held in that bigger space. We can, however, be dedicated to the energies of the klipot, so we can be dedicated to the level, to the reactivity of chata, the separated willfulness of pesha, or even, God preserve us, the deep desire for separation of Yvonne. So that beginning intention, that beginning seed are we cooperating with the divine breath, or are we rooting ourselves somewhere else, is one of the central questions. Because if we root ourselves in separation, well, of course, the fruit of our life will be separation. We become, instead of the grail that feeds, that blesses, that touches others, we become the anti-type of the grail. We become the idol. So either we are the icon that is continually deconstructing itself so as to allow the mysterious life and presence of the divine to keep flowing through us, or we become the idol that becomes swollen with its ability to grasp, to manipulate, to bind the world to itself. Yeah, and in the end, it's not the teachings that matter. Teachings are lovely. I love the teachings, as anyone who's ever been to my house, it's full of teachings. But that doesn't matter. What matters is the sense of presence and intention. What we come back to in the end in this is, and the teachings help us, the teachers keep us connected to something bigger than ourselves. But actually in the end, it is this simplicity of, okay, pay attention. What do I notice? What do I see? This is that first work of perception. Will I be the Tzaddik? Will I be the letter to Tzaddik? Will I bow and surrender to that which comes through me? And in that place, will I therefore then become the column that connects the worlds? Or will I refuse? Will I refuse to bow? Will I step away into some place of my own?
Is that to do with various levels? I mean, it could be personal level. Will I meet with him? What's going on in me? Or not, switch it off? Or do I see what's going on in my family, community?
Well, I think there's many, many, you're right, of course, there's many different levels of that, isn't there? Many different choices there for around that. So anyway, that is one of the, you know, whatever we meet it at whatever particular level. It could be something inside ourselves, could be something in our family, could be something in the community, could be something nationally. You know, it's a multi-level, kind of process. But if we can somehow let ourselves choose to, you know, the choice is really to be present or to step away. So if we can allow ourselves, if we can bear to be present, and we can't always actually, so it's not about judging ourselves when we can't. But it is about the big difference is what do we consciously choose to do? Because if we consciously choose, because the first level of the klipot is chata, which has a sort of degree. I mean, it's going to create very difficult things, and people can do terrible things on chata. But it has a sort of innocence about it. It is a reactivity. When we come into peshar and avon, we come into something that has a much more sense of choosing separation, almost the delight in hurting, the delight of being separate. Whereas mostly what we deal with in people and in ourselves is that reactive kind of defensive kind of trying to keep ourselves safe in a way that doesn't really kind of work. So the thing to watch always is that, okay, that first place of what do I choose? What am I aligning with? because the fruits of whatever we align with. So if I align with fear, I do something because I'm frightened, and I protect that frightened choice, and I cooperate with that frightened choice. Well, part of the fruits, part of what will flow through me, is fear, and the results of fear, and the desire for separation, and the images of separation will arise, and the sense of being a stranger in a strange world, and my actions will be predicated on that. If I can, to some extent at least, predicate myself, connect myself to that sense of being connected to a living world, to whatever extent I can do that, the energies that will follow from that will reflect that, will have that sense of however difficult things are, there is goodness in the universe, there is safety, there is the possibility of help. And as we saw in the last month, when we were looking at the rabbi from the Warsaw Ghetto, even in the most extreme situations, even when you know there is no help, there is the possibility of believing in something that is bigger, not believing in that case in any actual safety, because there was none for him and his people. But nonetheless, even in the midst of hell, there is that sense of there is something beyond this. This will end. It isn't all there is.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah, certainly. Yes.
Well, it's just the spirituality, you can think around these things differently, but in the major religions, are they all underpinned by the sense that the universe is beneficent? Or I suppose they don't believe in a sentient universe, do they? They think it's been created or something as lumps of stuff. Because it's a really big thing in my Druidry, mm-hmm. that there is an underlying harmony and a greater harmonious pattern. It doesn't matter whether I'm too small and short-lived to see it, because I know that it's there.
Well, I think all religions have that. I mean, I think, you know, in a sense, underneath Christianity is the deep belief in the beneficence of the divine, of the goodness of that. Also in Islam, even in a non-theistic religion like Buddhism, there is still a sense of the harmony of the universe, of the sense if you follow the eightfold or the threefold path, you will become free. So there is a sense. So I think and even in the Gnostic, some of the Gnostic teachings where they regard the universe as evil and to be got away from, there still is a larger sense of a harmony somewhere, so, really.
But in Judaism, there's a very harsh God, isn't there?
The divine in Judaism is both beneficent and harsh. Mm-hmm. Right, so he is a God of great love and who leads the Hebrews through the wilderness, who brings springs of sweet water out of stone, who provides manna, who shepherds them through terrible things, who opens the Red Sea for them. So there is a,
death of the firstborn and.
Well, that's him looking after the Hebrews. he's the God of the Hebrews, you know, not the God of the Egyptians. You know, shall there be evil in this house, and I, the Lord, not have accomplished it? So the divine here is beyond good and evil, a conventional sense of good and evil. It's why Evagrius Ponticus has as one of his contemplations the contemplation of providence and judgment. Mm. The contemplation of good and evil, as we conventionally understand this, is taken apart in some of these deeper teachings. And in a certain sense, the mystery of evil. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? Right? It's that eternal kind of question. And actually, that isn't a question there can ever be a logical answer to. That's Job's question to God. Why, you know, Job is the archetype of that question. Here's this good man who gives constantly to his neighbors, looks after people, is this thoroughly good egg, lovely man. Okay, and God strips him of everything. His children die, his wealth dies, his health goes, everything is stripped from him. And so he's in this enormous conversation with the divine. And what he's shown in the end is the mystery, the answer of that question, why do bad things happen to good people? But it's not a cognitive answer, it is his experience of the mystery of the unfolding universe. You know, the question, you know, if we made that question contemporary, why does God allow Putin to do this to people? Why didn't he give him a heart attack? It again is part of that mystery. Why is God allowing Trump to run again? Why isn't he locked up somewhere? You know, when we enter the contemplation of the divine, we enter into a profound mystery, which is why we are not God, perhaps fortunately.
But I think those questions are on a more facile level, though, aren't they? So it's sort of, if you like, a Greek being or lottery ticket with a personality that actually makes choices about whether people are good and whether bad things will happen. And I think
on
a larger scale.
No, but I think when in the real, Ben, I think when terrible things happen to us, I think that cry does absolutely arise out of that. Why is this going happening to me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't. You know, it's a very real question when that is happening. And the thing about the theology or any theology, really, is theology is only useful in as much as it enables our understanding, our embodied understanding of life. And of course, there are lots of discussions about goodness, evil, all of that. But to come back to the beginning of your question, all religions really have a belief in a sort of beneficence or a sort of sense of, or at the very least, a sense of meaning that gives them purpose.
Coherence, underlying coherence.
Yeah, totally. But. And in spiritual life, in deeper life, we have to abandon that belief, because that belief becomes an obstacle. It becomes a separating experience. Job, in his dialogue with the divine, relinquishes everything apart from his question of inquiry, apart from his sense of struggle with the divine, and then there is a breakthrough, something else happens. It's the thing that the Zen masters talk about when they tell people to chop up the Buddha. If you see the Buddha in the road, shoot him, kill him. Don't sit at his feet. Burn your burn.
If we hang on to that thing,
so burn.
We're just making ourselves into a little bubble.
Yeah, so burn. So
it's not real.
So burn the oak grove.
Sure.
Right? Kill the trees. Abandon the rituals.
Sorry, I'm still getting there with the oak trees. I feel ill.
No. the point, of course, that's the point, right? So the question is, well, what is it that we hold? What images do we hold to ourselves that prevent the deeper understanding?
Are you talking about surrender?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Right, completely. The real difficulty of surrender, though, because actually we're talking about real. With surrender, you know, people conventionally talk about, just let go. That isn't it. Real surrender is to let go of it is actually the death of the firstborn, the death of that which is most loved, most cherished, which is our sense of ourselves and the sense of the universe that we live in. So that is what we're asked. What is that? We're asked to surrender. Well, in the Abraham's sacrifice. Abraham binds Isaac on the altar of sacrifice on Mount Moriah. He's asked to give up that which is most precious to him. Now, it's a very powerful and honorable story, because if we remember the story of Abraham, his wife, he never thinks he's going to have a child. He miraculously has a child. He's given that. And then God says, well, I want him back now. Thanks very much. And you did kill him, and we'll kill him on my altar. It's a brutal story.
Teach that to year four.
Did you?
But anyway.
Well, the deeper meaning of it, right? The deeper meaning of that story is that because he binds Isaac, he puts him on the altar, he's about to bring the knife down. So he's completely about to kill his child. He's actually committed that. His knife is in the act of descending when his hand is caught by the angel. So he has given himself into the act. He's let go of it now, and then discovers what has to be sacrificed is not Isaac, but is a ram in a thicket. Now, it's a very particular image, because the ram represents the energy of initiation, of movement, of self-will. Yeah. And it's tangled in a thicket. Right, so it absolutely represents that self-involved will. That just gets us nowhere, that gets more and more tangled up. So what we're asked, the thing that is most cherished, more so, is our sense of our own autonomy, independence, ability to live separately. Mm. Our own commitment to separation is what is sacrificed on Mount Moriah.
So why does God ask him to sacrifice his son first?
Because his son is the thing he loves most.
Right.
The thing he's most attached to, completely. So that
wouldn't have been a challenge. He said, "Sacrifice the lamb."
No, it wouldn't be at all sacrifice, because he's got a lot. He's a rich man. He's got thousands of sheep.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he can easily give. He could give God 1,000 sheep, and he'd still be all right. It's his son that is most precious to him, the thing he is most attached to.
It's
so he might say to you, "Rob, give up your house. Give the keys to somebody." Mm. And walk away.
Mm. That'd be nothing. Yeah, kind of. You built up in your life or something. Yeah, yeah.
So if we took that idea, right? Give the keys of your house to somebody and walk away. Mm. What happens inside you?
Shock.
Gosh, it's frightening. You have to start again.
Yes.
Yeah. In the beginning. Yeah.
Yes.
I
can't understand that, because there is no way that I would kill my children. There's no way I would do
Lovely,
that.
This is an archetypal story, lovely. Okay?
Yeah, but the point...
The point of it isn't that you're... No, it's not about kill your children. It's not about that. It's what are you most attached to that stops your connection to life. Mm. Now, your connection to your children, because I know about your connection to your children, seems to be rather a good thing. Love your children. Right, this is an archetypal story that isn't about the literal killing of a child. It's about killing what is the thing that stops me? What is the thing I am most attached to that keeps me in the place of separation?
That stops life flowing. Yeah.
Yeah. So the question more, if we interpret that story into our lives, nobody's going to ask us to kill your kids. Right? But it would be, might be, what is it in my relationship to my children that stops my deeper life flowing? What is it I need to alter? And it may not be about your kids. We're just using that because it's the illustration. It's whatever it is that you hold to that keeps you in the place of separation. So in Abraham's case, because this is an archetypal, not a real story, never actually happened. In the story, the whole story, Isaac is the most precious. He's the thing that, above all, that Abraham could probably give away everything else, but he'd be fine if he could keep his son. So that what is asked of him is that surrender.
I can't remember the context of this story. Why does God ask that favor in the first place?
Well, he does because he does. Because he just does. Just because he does.
Yeah.
No, yeah. He's kind of, you know, the whole story of Abraham, right, is a story. So Abraham is the great, if you like, patriarch of of Judeo-Christianity, and he and it begins with under the oak of Mamre, with him inviting the angels to sit with him. And so he makes himself, so in a certain sense, what the story is saying is talking about the ability to bring the divine into our lives. His wife was very old, and they've desperately wanted a child, never has a child. And because he is invited in the angels, he is told that he will have a son, and from his son, many thousands of people will arise. And so the ask of him in the act of in Moriah is not just the loss of his son, but the loss of his whole future, of all the thousands of descendants. And so what's being looked at there is that part of Abraham who, instead of accepting the divine blessing, makes something of it. So what is needed is the death not of his child, but of his own attitude to being the big guy. His own separated self-will. And you know, the problem is, it's a terrible, shocking story, I know, but it isn't about killing kids. It never was. It's always about having to look at, well, what is it that I attach to, that I bind to me, that stops the deeper life flowing through me? That it is that needs, it's that attachment that needs to die.
And in a smaller way, that's what we did with the challenger at the Roll Rights. We sacrificed something.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah.
That mattered to us.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's transformed and brought back to us.
Yes, exactly. So that's the point, right? So that's the mystery. So the genuine mystery is, as we're able to offer and let go, something is returned to us in new form, in augmented form, in a bigger form.
Because it was quite frightening to do that bit. I mean,
it is
nothing to do with it.
No, definitely. Yeah. No, that's the point. It's this call and response, giving and receiving. Mm. You know, that's absolutely part of this work. Yeah.
I've got two. So one, when we did the card and we had to talk as if we were the card,
yeah,